welcome to this special edition of the Castle Bridge Podcast. On this episode, we have some special guests joining us to talk about whether the perfect is really the enemy of the good.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. We are now doing a special podcast for Castle Bridge. We've managed to get some experts around the table, the virtual table, to talk about the data privacy and data management issues that hang around, and also the data ethics issues that are linked to the emerging technology sector response and data sector response to the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen a lot of apps springing up. We've seen a lot of call for use of things like telecommunications data to be used to help with contact tracing and other things. And I thought it'd be worth getting some experts around the table to talk about this. So on the podcast today, we've got Pat Walsh, Privacy Matters on Twitter, Phil Booth from Med Confidential in the UK, and Ronan Lupton, who is a barrister in Ireland, specializing in data protection law, media law, and intellectual property law, but previously had worked as has worked in the regulatory sphere in the telecommunications sector for large multinationals. Welcome to the podcast, guys. And also, as always, we have Catherine, who is here to make sure that the boys don't wander off on a tangent talking about nerdy stuff. She's going to bring us back to the fundamentals of getting this done ethically and getting this done right. So where do you want to start, guys? Do you want to introduce yourselves briefly for the listeners? Pat, sure. Do you want to tell everyone who you are?
Okay, so I'm Pat Walsh, Privacy Matters on Twitter. I've been a data protection privacy professional in the mobile telecom sector, I guess, for nearly two decades. That's me.
Catherine, do you want to chime in there?
Sure. I'm obviously not a medical expert, and I think that's actually one of the things that we need to be aware of. I work in privacy and data ethics and data governance. But one of the things I've been noticing a lot is a lot of noise all over. Signal to noise ratio is really bad from non-medical experts when it comes to the things that we can do to respond to our current health crisis. So does anyone want to pick up on that a little bit?
Yeah. So Catherine, you're a doctor, but you're not that kind of doctor.
I am not that kind of doctor. I've actually removed the doctor from my Twitter handle because I got a couple people asking me questions related to medical issues, and I am not an MD. So I don't want any confusion there.
Phil, do you want to tell everyone who you are?
Sure. Phil Booth. I currently coordinate Med Confidential. Also not a doctor or a medic, but have been actually campaigning in and around data issues around health data, medical data, since about 2008. We set up Med Confidential in 2013. So we're engaging with the very specific issues around that type of what used to be sensitive personal data and now special category personal data, and issues not just around privacy and data protection, but confidentiality, which is a subtly different thing and brings in these all-important notions of trust, which lie at the heart of any healthcare system.
Okay, and Ronan?
Ronan Lupton. I'm a barrister practicing over in Dublin and Ireland. Similar to Pat, I have about 20 years of being around the telecoms and internet space. Started working in 98 for a company called GTS, then joined WorldCom, which went bust slightly after that, but was taken over eventually by Verizon. Had privilege to work with quite a few people who were founders of, I guess, standards on the internet. One of them was Vint Cerf, who wrote TCP/IP and some standards other than that on the ARPA project. So I was on a policy team with him, and I don't say that lightly because it was a privilege to work with someone who literally knows everything about how the internet operates. Over and above that, I guess my main role with Verizon was to keep an eye on and lobby with regulators. So I'm not going to tell you it wasn't lobbying because it was, but policy advocacy, I guess, is probably the best way to put it. One of the main areas we looked at was the retention of call records, privacy, the development of the e-commerce directive, the implementation of various state surveillance regimes, not just in Ireland, but across the world. And then obviously when data protection became, I guess, mainstream in sort of 95, 96, that time, moving right into today's sort of GDPR world, you know, I've been involved in that more on the periphery since I started practice in 08. But obviously my interest in this area is very significant. It's not a huge litigation area in Ireland, but certainly internationally it's developing, it's developing, I guess, area and somewhere where business is primarily focused. So that's my background. So very much on message and similar to both Phil, Pat and yourselves over at Castlebridge.
Fantastic. And just in terms of my background, for anyone who doesn't know, prior to founding Castlebridge, I spent 12 years in a small Irish telecommunications company that when I started, it began with a T, and when I left, it began with an E. And as part of that role, I was involved in quite a lot of back-end data stuff and looking at how data could be used from a strategic perspective, and also then moving into the regulatory side of telecoms data. I've also worked with Digital Rights Ireland on a number of things, including being involved on the periphery of a small and insignificant European Court of Justice case back in 2014, very much on the periphery. But again, it's an area that I've been pretty active in for a long time. And also data quality, another key area I've been working in. And that kind of leads into some of the topics we're going to talk about today, I think, in terms of if we're looking for data, is it always the right data for the need we actually have, or is it simply convenient data? So, well, the mutual backslapping out of the way, let's get on to talk about some of the key issues. We're seeing lots of apps looking at various aspects of COVID response. We're seeing everything from bots on websites to help with diagnosis and do assessments. We're seeing contact tracing apps, and we're seeing discussion around the use of telecoms data for contact tracing and for other aspects of pandemic response. Pat, what's going on? What's your take on things?
Well, yes, I'm a little bit concerned, I must admit, by this rash of apps and websites that have emerged to whereby people can input their symptoms and it goes to a website. When I look at some of them, it's difficult to know or impossible to know who is behind those websites. Some of the websites are simply insecure. From my consideration, my point of view, it seems that very little thought has been given to data protection and privacy of individuals. I guess, like Phil and Roland and others, and Catherine, I guess I'm deeply concerned by some of the ethics behind it, and I'm deeply concerned about the standards of data protection and privacy, to be honest. We may talk in a little bit, I guess, Dara, about the use of location data, which I'm prepared to talk a little bit more about, but it'd be good to hear what the others think.
Yeah, like Pat, I'm quite concerned at the just an incredible sort of number of you know, self-initiated projects at the moment. What we're dealing with here, if you are dealing with research studies in a pandemic situation, this is still human research. There are very clear rules at international level. The World Medical Association's Declaration of Helsinki says that every human study should be properly registered before any volunteer is recruited. In this, also in the UK, the Health Research Authority requires registration for some trials and studies. And in any case, pretty much anything that is doing stuff with human beings in their lives needs Research Ethics Committee approval if it is to be legitimate research. The fact that, you know, companies are just setting up and doing things, if they're not doing it in coordination with proper research teams based at universities or hospitals or national institutions, then we're just going to get a whole bunch of useless data. Yeah, it probably won't be gathered in the same way in any form that's going to actually be making a contribution to understanding, you know, the virus and the spread of the virus. So, you know, that's, you know, a bit of a problem now, but looking a little ahead, we are going to have other sorts of data, apps and things, particularly around immunity. Once we get the serological tests that show not just what we can see at the moment, which is whether there's the presence of the virus in the body, PCR test, but the serological test, which shows that you have the antibodies to the virus, we have to confront a very, very, very significant question, which is how we are going to basically monitor the difference between those people who are immune and those people who are not yet immune. That could be a central register, and obviously we'd be very, very strongly oppose that. It could be by some sort of verified credential. But you know, there are still going to be really serious issues about how we handle that as we move out of this phase, and unfortunately have to raise it during this phase. There are already signs that the data that we are gathering on the ground in the hospitals, and you know, this is planned for very clearly in the legislation that has just been passed. You know, they are beginning to just literally say we don't need to have things like a cremation certificate. Yeah, because we're going to have so many bodies to deal with. So we want to make sure that we are, for future purposes, we are maintaining due diligence around things like medical death certificates. Yeah, that's why the statistics may be slowing down a bit or looking a bit odd. You know, you need a medical examiner to sign off on every death and to report the notifiable disease. Those sorts of flows of data are what we need every day on a rolling basis to be able to understand the spread of what's going on. And it's something, while data is not often seen as critical as obviously delivering care itself, and it isn't in that sense. You know, families are going to need to know, you know, after the fact, you know, what happens to their relative when they went into the hospital. And we must be really clear that data in these circumstances is critical to that.
Ronan, any thoughts?
Well, I think I agree entirely with what Phil has said there. I guess my main concern is the abuse factor that could occur after the fact. Not only in terms of the human research point, but I guess continuity of state surveillance or surveillance after the pandemic has abated. Now, of course, as we may all know, none of us are medical doctors on this particular call. And, you know, the preservation and saving of life is obviously a key theme at the moment. It doesn't really matter about your privacy rights, you know, to some degree. And I don't want to cause an argument, obviously, on the podcast. But there is a kind
Ronan, that's what this podcast is for, is to have arguments.
Well, I mean, there is a sort of supervening issue, which is people are dying and, you know, what can we do to help? And that's fine in the sense of let's do what we can within the boundaries of what the law and regulation permits and do it quickly. But the key issue is, can the states, and I'm not talking specifically about Ireland, or you know, can member states or countries move fast enough within the legal frameworks to make amendments? The answer is probably not. But it does concern me, and it's one thing I would agree fully with Phil on, is suddenly you have these tech bros wearing t-shirts developing solutions that are not falling on all fours with what the legal requirements are, and they're not necessarily taking legal advice. And I know it's easy for me to say that, because I'm sitting here kind of doing paperwork and writing opinions from time to time on while this pandemic is occurring. But at the same time, they will make the same argument. You know, we're doing this for the greater good, let's just do it. But we've seen cases over the years, from 2014 onwards, where abuses have occurred. In fact, even as late as yesterday, there was a case in the UK Supreme Court dealing with a similar point about data being transferred where it shouldn't have been. Then, of course, you have the GDPR gurus who aren't really gurus saying, oh, well, we need patient consent to do things. And this is something I know Catherine and Dara and Pat and Phil and I have all discussed on Twitter in the last number of weeks, what the GDPR allows and doesn't allow. And really, it's not, it doesn't come into it in the sense of processing for the purposes of vital interests or, you know, medical reasons. So to some extent, we have that. But I do have a concern about recent announcements from the Commission with regard to anonymous, so anonymized location data and how that would be used firstly in the pandemic sense, and I think we have to say, well, go ahead and use it, but at the same time, where are the safeguards and the sunset clauses and the check balances and checksums to say, well, you know, you are doing this for a specific purpose for a limited time period, and that's fine. So I do have kind of, I get high-level concerns in respect of that. But it is slightly irritating, and you know, that we have the teachers wearing tech bros telling us in the legal sphere how things should work, and in the regulatory space, but also now dipping their surface devices into the medical sphere and saying, well, you know, we should do things this way. And the reality is they're not qualified to say those things. So, you know, lots of experts, but, you know, the medics need to be left do their job. And whatever we can do to enable that assistance, that's fine, but within the limits of what's reasonable and what's legal. So they're my kind of high-level thoughts.
Yeah, I'd agree, Ron. And one thing that concerns me, kind of bridging your points and Phil's points, is that I've seen a couple of apps that are spinning out of university-linked incubators, business incubators. And they seem to be parlaying their link to the university as if that is the thing that makes them kosher and okay. We're part of a university group, therefore you can trust us. I think this is where university ethics boards may have a role. And I think this is something that we should be keeping an eye on. I think how people perceive the truthiness and the trustiness of these apps is often linked to their apparent provenance. And if I was a university ethics board, or if I was someone managing European Commission funding for a university research program, I'd be a little bit concerned about the potential blowback if a t-shirt wearing tech bro in a startup that happened to be renting office space in our incubator center was suddenly claiming some sort of authority simply because they drink in the same coffee dock, or they have been drinking in the same coffee dock as some actual scientists and medics. The aspect then that I'd like to touch on in terms of the location data tracking, and the European Commission is talking about, and the European data EDPS came out with an interesting communication last night on the use of location data that raised some interesting points. But they're looking at using it for a number of different things. But always I find that the rush to looking at telecoms location data is quite often a solution in search of a problem. Pat, what would your thoughts be on that? Is it a solution in search of a problem, or is there anything actually useful we can get from the location data derived from devices connected to a public communications network?
So I think, Dar, one of the problems we have there, and those that follow me on Twitter would have seen my comments, is that we don't simply know enough about this. And I saw the response, the communication from the EDPS to Thierry Breton about the Commission's intention to require operators to supply them location data. And it seems to me from that response from the EDPS that even the EDPS hasn't had sufficient detail to understand. I mean, where is the information available that lets those of us who know these things understand whether or not this data can be used? Is this to be used for contact tracing? I mean, if it's to be used for contact tracing, then location data, as it seems to be being proposed, won't be of value, simply because, and you know this, Dara, Roland, you've worked in the industry, you know this, because of the granularity, the levels of granularity of this data. And, you know, it makes me think back to the Ebola outbreak in 2014, when we were, when I worked for the GSMA then, and we were trying to understand if mobile data could help inform how Ebola was spread and how you might provide medical interventions, etc., and prevent the spread of that terrible disease. But mobile data didn't at the end of the day. It was discovered there, for example, that it was spread through the washing of bodies more than the movement of people. And I'm just not convinced that location data is appropriate or necessary or justified to be used in terms of efforts for contact tracing. I just think the utility isn't there. And I noticed this morning that the Future Privacy Forum in the US has also put out a series of blogs to this effect as well. And I think it's kind of shocking that the European Commission are not providing the details of the arrangements with mobile operators. And I think we should also bear in mind, Dara, that, you know, since 2002, which, you know, the e-privacy directive of 2002 brought about obligations and rights in relation to traffic and location data. And in their Article 15, which still applies today, in the amended directive, permitted member states to adopt laws to allow the use of location data, for example, and traffic data in these kinds of emergencies. That's 18 years ago. Why has it taken COVID for the Commission and for others to begin now to panic about whether or not mobile data is a value? Personally, I don't think it is.
Yeah. From my point of view, what we have here is a very fundamental data quality problem. Mobile data may have uses, depending on what is the problem we're trying to solve. But to use it, we need to look at the legal issues surrounding its use. And Pat, you're right. We've had 18 years to legislate for its use, and no one has bothered. But more importantly, a simple data point. We're being asked to physically distance by 2 meters. The granularity of mobile cell location data is very, very rarely down to the level of 2 meters. And if the thing that identifies that you are in contact with someone who is infectious and that you've been in contact with them for longer than a defined period of time is that you've been closer than 2 meters for more than 15 minutes, for example, mobile phone location data isn't going to give you that reliably. Other technologies might.
So I'd like to pick up on that a little bit too. Pat mentioned the Ebola epidemic and the issues there with using telecoms location data. And I wasn't personally involved with that, but I've heard a good bit about it from a man who was working for the International Red Cross at the time. And one of the things that they were looking at there was finding clusters of populations in order to provide support to where people were rather than tracing. And for that, they found it a little bit more useful, definitely more useful than you would for contact tracing. But the problem that they came up with was the fact that that data was then unfortunately also visible to the Taliban. So the risks downstream are incredibly high, whereas, as Pat was saying, the actual usage for support was lower than hoped. So what is the usefulness? What is our purpose for using this data? Does it work? What are the risks? Those are still the questions we're coming into contact with now.
Absolutely. Sorry, Phil.
Right. I mean, we need to be very clear here. We've talked about various sorts of data, and it may be that listeners are not actually aware of the differences between the types of data that a mobile device and a mobile network works with. Let us be very, very clear. Yeah, cell location data, yeah, aggregate, you know, that can tell you how many devices are near a particular cell, yeah, can be useful in terms of if we've been people have been told not to congregate in more than, you know, ones or twos. If you can see a large aggregation of people, it may be worth deploying resources there to disperse a group. That is not contact tracing. That is just simply the sort of thing that one might do from that type of data. And at aggregate level, frankly, I don't think that, certainly in this sort of crisis, is a problem. I agree completely that cell location data doesn't have the granularity to do any sort of contact tracing, but that's not the technology that are being used by Trace Together in Singapore, by Private Kit from MIT, by Hamagen in Israel. They're using low energy Bluetooth, yeah? And, you know, so it's a, you know, there are different ways in which devices may be used in different contexts and as Gavin says, you know, for different purposes. But we have to be clear that, you know, just dumping a whole bunch of data from the telecoms companies to the government is not going to sort anything.
So there are a couple of. Sorry, is that Roland?
No, that was me moving because I've been sitting in an awkward position for a few minutes.
So those conversations raised a number of things. So yes, where I said that mobile data is of no utility value, it isn't in relation to contact tracing. But of course, yes, it will show where people are congregating, as Phil says. It will show where people are moving, the areas that people are moving between, and it may have some value there. However, as Catherine says, then you've also got to think about group risks and group harms, which, you know, if we think beyond the UK and Ireland, for example, then there are genuine concerns in many other countries. But just to take an example for here, I live in a small isolated community in rural Oxfordshire. Location data is going to be of no value at all, except to understanding the movement in and out of a village, for example. People across from us, two members of that family, believe they've had COVID. Our next door neighbour yesterday, they believe that two people in that family had COVID, and now one person in that family has had COVID. It was in bed for 3 days. Now, we don't know. And actually, you know, many of us would actually like to provide data via, yes, an app, a trustworthy app. But the problem that we face is that there is no app that I have seen yet that I trust. So where is trust? Because without trust, without an assurance of good governance, of safeguarding me, of safeguarding my data, of being able to use that data for the broader good, then we're not going to use it. We are here in this community, and we don't have a means to communicate things because we don't have trust and confidence.
And I think that's actually one of the key issues with the rush to solutions, is that we need to make sure that the wrapper that we have, the care and attention to the privacy controls and communicating how the technology works. Phil said, rightly pointed out, there's different types of data for different things in a mobile device context. Being clear with users, what is the data, what's being used, and also what's the provenance, if you're, for example, if it's a diagnostic bot, what's the provenance of the logic that's sitting behind that bot, and where is that data going? Who's using it? I've looked at one app website with the bot, diagnostic bot, earlier this last week, where it appears that the communication stream from the bot is going back to a Russian IP address through a Russian ISP. Now, that may be perfectly okay from an operational perspective, but it's cross-border data transfer to a jurisdiction with a very different regime from a data protection perspective and privacy perspective, and very different state access rules in relation to the ability of the state to access data held by ISPs. But again, none of that was apparent from the communication and the documentation and the privacy statement, which was frankly generic. It might have been taken off the back of a box of cornflakes. I think that brings us to the ethical point of these tools and technologies and the need for organizations and for governments and for people to be thinking about these issues, because what I'm concerned about is we are seeing potentially organizations or governments spending a lot of time and resource, scarce time and resource, pursuing initiatives and options that frankly aren't going to fly or aren't going to solve the appropriate immediate problem. And that's not going to help anyone. Any thoughts, guys? Ronan, you've been quiet for a while. You probably muted yourself.
I did. I'm muting myself. I'm terribly sorry.
No, that's fine. That shows good remote working etiquette.
Yes. Well, anyway, I think I certainly agree with almost everything Pat and Philip said there. The one thing I'm slightly concerned about in terms of the European Commission notification was the issue of anonymity and use of anonymized data. I just don't think this is something I have a particular view on in terms of the internet, for example, but also mobile phone signals and information that can be collected and used, is that I don't really believe in anonymity is something that exists at all. That may be kind of an ecumenical point, but I think until such time as we have sort of trust and ethics that can be built into data uses, you need to be particularly careful. But of course, then policymakers will say, oh, sure, look, we have a pandemic going on, we have to do certain things. And that's all well and good. But then you have the tech bro situation kind of jumping up and they go, well, we're going to do this because without any caution in terms of how data can effectively be utilized. But one thing I did want to just touch upon, Dara, just following on, was this other category of information, which is advanced mobile location data, and LBS, I think, is the other acronym for it, which is location-based services. And I just note that in the UK and Ireland, and I think partially in France, for both Android and iOS devices, that those types of data will fall outside of what we would normally look at in the nuts and bolts telco world, where we're thinking about triangulation, which I think is, as we said in this call, and Phil was right, next to useless when it comes to anything other than maybe a crowd gathering or a very broad investigation as to where a mobile phone handset was at a particular point in time and where it was located on a cell. But AML and LBS bring you down into a more granular ability to locate somebody and even go so far as to put tokens on phones, which might be interesting in the contact tracing context. So if somebody attends at a COVID-19 assessment or treatment center, their phone has the necessary permissions to drop a token onto it. They leave the test center with no liquid diagnosis other than handing over swabs. And later they're found to have some strain of this, which is stronger than other people or whatever. And again, you know, it's serology testing. It's not going to be delivered back to them within 24 hours. It's going to be a week to 2 weeks. And, you know, there are issues there in terms of how that particular information is used and the infirmity of handsets and those types of issues. So I think it's actually still an open discussion about, I guess, the more unexpected types of surveillance and uses of information that, you know, can, or abuses, if you want to put it that way, of information that can occur, which mightn't be that obvious. Because I, for one, would be always thinking along the lines of, well, you know, we can track the caller by using the old school data retention mechanism of AND, BND, or AND SMS, BND SMS, or location data in terms of triangulation and analysis of cells. But in fact, it's even more pervasive now where it's down on the actual handset. And there may be some room here for the social media companies to come in on this. And I think I saw an EDPS statement on Sunday, I think, to the extent of the interplay between Article 15 of the Privacy Directive and how that would operate. But again, the summary, I think, which is carried forward into the European Commission's thinking was, sure, look, it's anonymized data. We're in a pandemic and isn't everything fine? So I'm not so sure I'm that happy with that outcome. You know? So that's my 10 cent on that.
That's one of the, it's the law of large numbers. The more data you have, the less likely it is that it's anonymous. And that's the problem we have when we're looking at bulk data in a telecommunications context, or even that level of targeted device tracking. Once you have enough data points, you are able to single that person out from the crowd. I use the example when we're teaching, and this is where Catherine has spotted me encountering the generational divide, because I use the example of the movie The Usual Suspects at the very end of the movie when they piece together the identity of Kaiser Soze from all the bits of information on the notice board behind the detective. We're in that sort of landscape where the more information you have, the richer profile you can build of an individual. But all that goes back ultimately to trust and transparency. Catherine, do you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, we keep on coming back around to the idea that, you know, tech bros are being solutionist on this and not being clear on what they're doing. And I think that's a really important thing. It's coming back to the beginning of the conversation again that Phil was talking about, the requirements of universities to have ethics boards and the trust that is engendered by that. But what we're seeing, understandably, everyone wants to do something right now because we are in a crisis. So there's some very, very well-intentioned trying to find a solution very quickly. The idea that we can, you know, band together and crowdsource solutions that will help. But without expert guidance, without that trust of understanding that, yes, this is something that needs to be done properly in order to actually be effective, to be trustworthy, to not cause more noise and have the signal lost in it, we do need to have more control over this, whether it's questioning the legalities when it comes to GDPR and privacy issues, but simply in having something that works. A lot of tech bros seem to have this idea that because they're really good at one thing, they are very, very good at everything else. And expertise is not always transferable. So that's one of the things that I'm just noticing a lot We need to make sure that we are led by epidemiologists, by medical experts, by people who have thought deeply about this.
So what you're saying, Catherine, is that fail fast is probably the worst approach to iterative innovation to have during a pandemic?
Yes.
And we should also be
millions of debt. You really don't want to get into that sort of equation. I agree very much with Ronan, and I think with Dara here. Anonymity, saying that you have anonymized data in this context, ludicrous. We know from studies going years back. I think the New York taxi one was probably the most notorious. That location data is particularly identifying. You need maybe as few as 4 location points over time to be able to identify 95% of the data set. So, let's not muck around. It speaks to what I think is more important than just trust, but trustworthiness.
Yeah? Yes.
I don't know if you know the very sort of eloquent TED talk that Anora Anil gave, where she said, we don't need to be talking about trust, we need to be talking about trustworthiness, and what the components of that are. Is the person competent? Are they honest? And are they reliable? And if you're presenting yourself and saying the stuff we're using is anonymous or anonymized, just sort of hiding behind that rather than actually being upfront and saying, look, we're taking data that is possible to identify you from, I don't think you're being fully honest. So you're undermining your very trustworthiness of yourself by trying to make those sorts of claims. And of course, if you're not providing the transparency that people can see that you are being competent and reliable in what you are doing, you're doing what you say you'll do, and only that and nothing else. And as Dara said, you're not routing it through weird data protection regimes in the way of Russia or what have you. So, people, I think, this has been an inevitable response to a crisis. I think people need to sort of just take a breath and start to notice in the landscape those, as Catherine says, those initiatives and efforts that are actually being led by epidemiologists, by virologists, by properly research ethic approved and health research authority and all the equivalent in each nation state's proper health authorities, and just ignore the stuff that may have better marketing or a flashier looking button for its app, and look to what this thing is actually likely to do. It's on us partially. Let's not all just stampede to the next shiniest thing, but let's use our common sense and say, would I trust this in any other circumstance?
Yeah, I certainly don't trust the organizations and companies that have had a history of wanting to grab all the data to do anything other than grab all the data with a nice, shiny, we're doing it to save the world today.
Absolutely.
Well, I a concern I have when I look at one that's doing the rounds on Twitter is that when I look at the background to that app and the precursor to the current entity, it has its origins in ad tech, it's seed funded, it's morphed from one thing into now being a COVID app. And like Phil, like Catherine, I just want a sense that someone is in control of this. I want a sense that someone is addressing this. And I just don't get that at all. But I just wondered if I could just touch on Roland's point about device-based data and contact tracing. There's a really excellent blog that, and I'm going to pronounce his name incorrectly, I know now, it's Jaap Henk Hoopman, and he has a blog on Hansel and Gretel and the virus, privacy-conscious contact tracing, which I would urge people to read. I published it yesterday, and he has some very interesting ideas about privacy-preserving protocols or a privacy-conscious protocol. Using handset drive data and handset processing. And I think we should be looking at that, because at the moment this seems to be such a panic to take Phil's point, and I think people should step back. And I think people should be seriously looking at ideas such that Jaap Henk has proposed as well.
Well, look, I'm going to take an analogy from a previous job I had. When I was in university, I worked in a cinema. We had to train every weekend. We trained for fire evacuations on a Saturday morning. And the first thing we were trained was, when you have to do an evacuation, look at the environment in your area and take the appropriate steps to evacuate safely. We didn't follow a rigid evacuation plan. We always had fallback plans, and we also didn't rush an evacuation. We followed a very structured set of processes and decision-making controls that meant that when we did have to evacuate, when there was an incendiary bomb threat phoned in, we were able to evacuate the entire cinema very, very quickly, very, very efficiently, without any staff member actually having to talk to each other. But that's because we paid attention to the fundamentals of the good practices we've been trained in by our fire officer. And that's something, going back to what Phil said, where's the providence? Who's leading it? Going back to what Ronan said in terms of the legal structures and the consideration of legal structures and the evidence of that consideration, and Pat's comment there about what is the actual technology and the approaches that we're taking. I think less haste, more speed might be an appropriate response. We're coming to the end of our slot. I just want to ask everybody a quick question. After all, after this crisis, after we flattened the curve and the panic of the pandemic is over, how are we going to put the genie back in the bottle? What happens if we've gone too far with these technologies and we can't walk them back? What are your thoughts? Phil, you go. You want to take this one first?
My basic thought on this is that the pandemic planning that we've had for years, over a decade over here, is that life will return to normal after this. And rather than last year, where there were four types of flu, there will be five. And so, whatever anyone does now, because there are emergency conditions and bits of leeway, much of it will just simply have no legal basis whatsoever outside of a public health emergency, and I imagine we should shut it down. The thing people should keep in their heads all the time, I think, is, what is it going to mean when we reopen Heathrow? Are we going to reopen it as China, or are we going to reopen it with the values of the UK that we all valued before we went into this, and I hope we're still going to value coming out of it?
Ronan, what's your thought?
Well, I think it's necessary for me to refer to Michael Ryan, the director of the WHO, where he said the following, and this language applies to many things in life. Perfection is the enemy of the good when it comes to emergency management. Speed trumps perfection. The greatest error is not to move. The greater error is to be paralyzed by fear of failure. If you need to be right before you move, you will never win. Now, you can apply that to many areas of your life. You can apply that to the saving of lives and the dealing with pandemics, contact tracing, you can take your pick. But I think at the moment, that particular strand of text that Mr. Ryan put out there, and he was dealing with his experience with Ebola, for example, which I know we talked about earlier, is very, very interesting. However, when you look at the WHO and you look at Dr. Ryan and these people, they operate as experts in their field, and they operate within the strictures of regulation, of good grounds, of good ethics, of good hygiene, if you want to put it that way. And I don't mean that in the cleanliness sense, I mean it in the sense of doing the morally correct thing to do to save lives. So when you translate that into the technical, technological, legal and regulatory world, your question was, how do we put the genie back in the bottle? The answer is you probably won't be able to. But I am enthused to see, and I note from another area of my practice, that at least the drafters and framers of GDPR had in mind vital interests, medical interventions, and processing of sensitive data, and how the carve-out come about. Well, I think at this point, what we're going to have is a situation where drafting of legislation, for example, in the telecom space, is going to have to take into account some of the items Pat mentioned, in terms of ML, LBS sort of regulation, what way it should work properly, ethically, and quickly.
One thing I'm not looking forward to is when the T-shirt wearing tech bro decides to appear at the TEDx talk in a year's time, telling everybody that they saved the world from their bedroom in South County Dublin. I just don't think I look forward to that particular day, because the reality is that that's just not right. There are multiple experts sitting in hospitals at the moment, literally triaging patients as they come through the door. So the industry needs to do what it can, but needs to do what it can within the ethical structures and strictures that are laid down by law insofar as they operate. So they're my thoughts. And I'm sorry for reading a quote in, but I really like what Mr. Ryan had to say. But that is not a loose set of language he used, but it does apply to many, many things, including us working within the boundaries of what's good, right and proper in our particular areas.
Pat?
I'd also agree with Roland there on Mr. Ryan, to be honest. I'd also agree with Roland that I don't think you can put the genie back in the bottle, but I think you can ensure that the use of the genie is used judiciously, is used wisely and with appropriate controls. I worry, Dara, that just to go back to the Ebola situation again, because I was actively involved in policy decision making at that time, and also in putting in place data enclaves inside operator premises where data was anonymized, blah, 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 blah. And a worrying thing for me from a policy perspective is that I see from that measures that require operators to hand data to telecom operators. So the telecom operator can then, the telecom regulator can then decide who the data is going to be shared with in these kind of situations. That's wrong. And here I see operators in Europe giving data to the commission. I think we need to be concerned deeply about these activities, and we need to understand how they operate on a clear legal basis. We need to understand how we put constraints over those rights that come from that legal basis. And we need to ensure that they are time limited, but we need to ensure also that there is independent oversight and scrutiny of those measures too, as well. And I am worried that a lot of this depends on private sector tech bros who want to save the world. Yes.
Catherine.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's really been said. One of the things that Ronan pointed out, I think, is, well, a couple of things that he pointed out are quite important. With GDPR and the structures that we do have here in Europe, we have principles for purpose limitation, for things like storage limitation, making sure we only keep things as long as necessary. And we do need to ensure those are followed. And of course, I'm coming from a dual citizen perspective here, watching the Patriot Act, which was emergency legislation for a specific purpose that then is still, decades later now, used in order to curtail civil liberties and have immense powers of surveillance. We don't want that to happen. But the other thing that Ronan said that I think is really important is remembering where the real life-saving work is happening right now, and it's not the tech bros. We can find technological solutions to help support the real life-saving work, but our resources should be going to the people who are saving the lives, to the healthcare workers, to everyone who's supporting the healthcare workers, and all of our medical experts who are putting so much work in right now to save the world.
Yeah, my take on this is that we're not going to put the genie back in the bottle. But we do need to make sure the genie is less malevolent gin and more Robin Williams Disney type genie as we go forward. What this whole crisis has highlighted is the need for governments to invest in proper planning to make sure that appropriate legislation, safeguards, and processes are in place in advance to make use of appropriate technologies in the right way to get the right data to the right people at the right time to drive the right decisions. Now, this is 2020 hindsight. In Ireland, we've had at least 10 years of underinvestment in areas of our health system, not least in areas of information management and data management. This is an opportunity going forward for us to address those issues. what we need to make sure is that when we're addressing those issues going forward, as Catherine has said, we're not necessarily being tempted by the shiny toys of the tech bros, but we're actually looking with a clear understanding of what data is needed, for what purpose, and when, and what controls and safeguards are we going to put in place around those technologies so they are not misused or abused. But much like when I was in university and we were evacuating a cinema, we need to be in a position where public health authorities, public health doctors, and healthcare systems are able to take the tools down off the shelf and have a very clear protocol for implementing them when they're needed. And I think that's what I'd like to see coming out of this in the not too distant future, rather than the reactions that we're seeing now, where everyone's running around looking for more data, but it isn't necessarily the right data, and it might create more problems down the road than it's actually solving today. Okay, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us. Thank you, Ronan, for taking some time out of your morning. Thank you, Phil, and thank you, Pat. And of course, thank you, Catherine. The regular Castlebridge podcast will be coming out in the next few days as well, but this was a special edition, just looking at some of the data management and data protection and data ethics issues of our current pandemic situation. And I'd just like to ask everyone who's listening, if you do have an opportunity to support any volunteering group or a group that is supporting frontline healthcare workers, please make sure you do that. The working title for today's podcast was "Damn It, Jim, I'm an Engineer, Not a Doctor." A tribute to Star Trek and a sanitary lesson to all those t-shirt-wearing tech bros out there. In an interesting postscript to today's podcast, Michael Ryan, the man leading the World Health Organization's response to the coronavirus crisis, had some interesting comments today about data, technology, and fundamental human rights. I've taken some of his comments from the press conference and I've appended them to the podcast for your listening pleasure.
There is a tremendous amount of innovation, a huge amount of enthusiasm, but we need to turn that innovation and enthusiasm in a really structured way into products that work for frontline workers, that work for frontline systems. And that's what we're in the process of doing now. We do always have to have in the back of our minds, especially when it comes to collecting information on individual citizens or tracking their whereabouts or movements, that there are always very serious data protection, human rights, and principles that are involved. And we're very, very cognizant of that. And we want to ensure that all products that are developed are done in the most sensitive way possible, and that we never step beyond the principles of individual freedoms, rights, for individuals and for society. But yes, there are tremendous amount of collaborations ongoing.